and patients under anesthesia using carbon dioxide. Southam's study was included as example number 17. Despite scientists' fears, the ethical crackdown didn't slow scientific progress. In fact, research flourished. And much of it involved Gila. Chapter 18. Strangest Hybrid, 1960 to 1966. By the 1960s, scientists joked that Gila cells were so robust that they could probably survive in sink drains or on doorknobs. They were everywhere. The general public could grow Gila at home using instructions from a Scientific American do-it-yourself article. And both Russian and American scientists had managed to grow Gila in space. Henrietta's cells went up in the second satellite ever in orbit, which was launched by the Russian space program in 1960. And almost immediately afterward, NASA shot several vials of Gila into space in the Discoverer 18 satellite. Researchers knew from simulated zero-gravity studies using animals that space travel could cause cardiovascular changes, degradation of bone and muscle, and a loss of red blood cells. They also knew radiation levels were higher beyond the ozone layer. But they didn't know what effects any of this would have on humans. Would it cause cellular changes, or even cell death? When the first humans went into orbit, Henrietta's cells went with them, so researchers could study the effects of space travel, as well as the nutritional needs of cells in space, and how cancerous and non-cancerous cells responded differently to zero gravity. What they found was disturbing. In mission after mission, non-cancerous cells grew normally in orbit, but Gila became more powerful, dividing faster with each trip. And Gila cells weren't the only ones behaving strangely. Since the start of the decade, researchers had been noticing two new things about all cultured cells. First, it seemed that all normal cells growing in culture eventually died or underwent spontaneous transformation and became cancerous. This phenomenon was exciting for researchers trying to understand the mechanisms of cancer, because it suggested that they might be able to study the moment a normal cell becomes malignant. But it was disturbing for those trying to use cell culture to develop medical therapies. George Hyatt, a Navy doctor working with the National Cancer Institute, had experienced this phenomenon firsthand. He'd cultured human skin cells for treating badly burned soldiers, then created a wound on a young volunteer officer's arm and smeared the cells across it, hoping they'd grow to form a new layer of skin. If it worked, it might mean doctors could use skin cell transplants to treat wounds in the field. The cells did grow, but when Hyatt biopsied them a few weeks later, they were all cancerous. He panicked, removed the cells, and hadn't tried transplanting skin cells since. The other unusual thing scientists had noticed about cells growing in culture was that once they transformed and became cancerous, they all behaved alike, dividing identically and producing exactly the same proteins and enzymes, even though they'd all produced different ones before becoming malignant. Louis Coryell, a renowned cell culturist, thought he might have an explanation. He published a paper suggesting that perhaps transformed cells behaved the same not because they'd become cancerous, but because they'd been contaminated by something, most likely a virus or bacterium, that made them behave similarly. Almost as an aside, he pointed out one possibility that other researchers hadn't considered. All transformed cells seem to behave identically to Gila, he wrote, which could mean that Gila was the contaminant. Soon after his paper was published, Coryell and a few other top tissue culturists called an urgent meeting to talk about the state of their field, which they worried was becoming a disaster. They'd mastered the techniques of cell culture and simplified them to such a degree that, as one researcher put it, they'd made it possible for even the rank amateur to grow a few cultures. In recent years, using tissue samples from themselves, their families, and their patients, scientists had grown cells of all kinds: prostate cancer, appendix, foreskin, even bits of human cornea, often with surprising ease. Researchers were using that growing library of cells to make historic discoveries: that cigarettes caused lung cancer, how X-rays and certain chemicals transformed normal cells into malignant ones, why normal cells stopped growing and cancer cells didn't. And the National Cancer Institute was using various cells, including HeLa, to screen more than 30,000 chemicals and plant extracts, which would yield several of today's most widely used and effective chemotherapy drugs, including vincristine and Taxol. Despite the importance of this research, many scientists seemed cavalier about their cultures. Few kept clear records of which cells grew from which donors, and many mislabeled their cultures, if they labeled them at all. For scientists doing research that wasn't cell-specific, like investigating the effects of radiation on DNA, not knowing what kind of cell they were working on might not affect the outcome of their research. But if cells were contaminated or mislabeled in research that was cell-specific, as much research was, the results would be worthless. Regardless, the culturists who called the meeting said precision was essential in science, and researchers should know what cells they were using and whether they were contaminated. According to Robert Stevenson, one of the scientists involved in the meeting, their goal was to keep the field from degenerating into complete chaos. The group encouraged researchers to use protective measures, like working under hoods with suction that pulled air and potential contaminants into a filtration system. And they recommended that the NIH establish a reference collection of cells, a central bank where all cultures would be tested, cataloged, and stored under maximum security using state-of-the-art sterile techniques. The NIH agreed and formed a Cell Culture Collection Committee made up of tissue culturalists including William Scherer, Lou Coryell, and Robert Stevenson. Their mission was to establish a nonprofit federal cell bank at the American Type Culture Collection, ATCC, which had been distributing and monitoring the purity of bacteria, fungi, yeast, and viruses since 1925, but never cultured cells. The scientists on the collection committee set out to create the Fort Knox of pure, uncontaminated cell culture. They transported cultures in locked suitcases and developed a list of criteria all cells had to meet before being banked. Each had to be tested for any possible contamination, and they all had to come directly from the original source. Cell number one in the ATCC's collection was the L cell, the original immortal mouse cell line grown by Wilton Earle. For cell number two, the committee contacted Guy, asking for a sample from the original HeLa culture. But in his initial excitement, Guy had given all the original HeLa cells to other researchers and kept none for himself. He eventually tracked some down in the lab of William Scherer, who'd used some of the original HeLa sample in their polio research. Initially, the committee could only test samples for viral and bacterial contamination. But soon a few of its members developed a test for cross-species contamination, so they could determine whether cultures labeled as being from one animal type were actually from another. They quickly found that of 10 cell lines thought to be from 9 different species, including dog, pig, and duck, all but one were actually from primates. They promptly relabeled those cultures, and it seemed they'd gotten the situation under control without attracting any bad publicity. The media, it turned out, was far more interested in a bit of HeLa-related news that was almost as sensational as Alexis Carrel's immortal chicken heart. And it all started with cell sex. In 1960, French researchers had discovered that when cells were infected with certain viruses in culture, they clumped together and sometimes fused. When they fused, the genetic material from the two cells combined, as with sperm meeting egg. The technical name for this was somatic cell fusion, but some researchers called it cell sex. It was different from sperm and egg sex in several important ways. Somatic cells were cells of the body, like skin cells, and their union produced offspring every few hours. Perhaps most important, cell sex was entirely controlled by researchers. Genetically speaking, humans are terrible research subjects. We're genetically promiscuous. We mate with anyone we choose, and we don't take kindly to scientists telling us who to reproduce with. Plus, unlike plants and mice, it takes us decades to produce enough offspring to give scientists much meaningful data. Since the mid-1800s, scientists had studied genes by breeding plants and animals in specific ways: a smooth pea with a wrinkled one, a brown mouse with a white one, then breeding their offspring to see how genetic traits passed from one generation to the next. But they couldn't study human genetics the same way. Cell sex solved that problem, because it meant researchers could combine cells with any traits they wanted and study how those traits were passed along. In 1965, two British scientists, Henry Harris and John Watkins, took cell sex an important step further. They fused HeLa cells with mouse cells and created the first human-animal hybrids, cells that contained equal amounts of DNA from Henrietta and a mouse. By doing this, they helped make it possible to study what genes do and how they work. In addition to the HeLa mouse hybrid, Harris fused HeLa with chicken cells that had lost their ability to reproduce. His hunch was that when those deactivated chicken cells fused with HeLa, something inside HeLa would essentially turn the chicken cell back on. He was right. He didn't know how it worked yet, but his discovery showed that something in cells regulated genes, and if scientists could figure out how to turn disease genes off, they might be able to create a form of gene therapy. Soon after Harris's HeLa chicken study, a pair of researchers at New York University discovered that human-mouse hybrids lost their human chromosomes over time, leaving only the mouse chromosomes. This allowed scientists to begin mapping human genes to specific chromosomes by tracking the order in which genetic traits vanished. If a chromosome disappeared and production of a certain enzyme stopped, researchers knew the gene for that enzyme must be on the most recently vanished chromosome. Scientists in laboratories throughout North America and Europe began fusing cells and using them to map genetic traits to specific chromosomes, creating a precursor to the human genome map we have today. They used hybrids to create the first monoclonal antibodies, special proteins later used to create cancer therapies like Herceptin, and to identify the blood groups that increased the safety of transfusions. They also used them to study the role of immunity in organ transplantation. Hybrids proved it was possible for DNA from two unrelated individuals, even of different species, to survive together inside cells without one rejecting the other, which meant the mechanism for rejecting transplanted organs had to be outside cells. Scientists were ecstatic about hybrids. But throughout the United States and Britain, the public panicked as the media published one sensational headline after the next. Man-animal cells are bred in lab. The next step could be tree men. Scientists create monsters. The Times of London called the HeLa mouse cells the strangest hybrid form of life ever seen in the lab or out of it. A Washington Post editorial said, "We cannot afford any artificially induced mouse men." It called the research horrendous and said the researchers should leave humans alone and go back to their yeasts and fungi. One article ran with an image of a half-human, half-mouse creature with a long, scaly tail. Another ran with a cartoon of a hippopotamus woman reading the newspaper at a bus stop. The British press called the Gila hybrids an assault on life and portrayed Harris as a mad scientist. And Harris didn't help the situation. He caused near pandemonium when he appeared in a BBC documentary saying that the eggs of man and ape could now be joined to create a mape. Harris and Watkins wrote letters to editors complaining that they'd been quoted out of context, their story sensationalized to distort, misrepresent, and terrify. They assured the public that they were just creating cells, not trying to produce centaurs. But it didn't help. A public survey about their research was overwhelmingly negative, calling it pointless and dangerous. An example of men trying to be gods. And the PR problem for cell culture was only going to get worse from there. Chapter 19. The most critical time on this earth is now. 1966 to 1973. When Deborah was a junior in high school, at the age of 16, she got pregnant with her first child. Babette cried when she found out. Deborah stopped going to school, and Babette said, "Don't get too comfortable, 'cause you're going to graduate." Deborah yelled right back, saying she couldn't go to school all big and pregnant. "That don't matter," Babette said. "You're going to that special girls' school where all the pregnant girls have big bellies just like you." Deborah refused. But Babette filled out the application for her and dragged her there for her first day of class. On November 10th, 1966, Deborah gave birth to Alfred Jr., who she named after his father, Alfred Cheetah Carter, the boy Galen had once been jealous of. Each morning, Babette made Deborah's lunch, got her to school, then took care of Alfred all day and most of the night so Deborah could go to class and study. When Deborah graduated, Babette made her get her first job. Whether Deborah liked it or not, Babette was going to help her and that baby. Deborah's older brothers were doing fine on their own. Lawrence went into business for himself, opening a convenience store in the basement of an old townhouse. Sonny had graduated from high school, joined the Air Force, and grown into a handsome ladies' man. He did some running around, but pretty much stayed out of trouble. Their younger brother, Joe, was another story. Authority didn't agree with Joe. He argued with teachers and brawled with other students. He dropped out of school in the 7th grade and ended up in court for assault by striking right after his 17th birthday. He joined the military at 18, but his anger and attitude got him in even more trouble there. He fought his superiors and other soldiers. Sometimes he ended up in the hospital, but more often than not, his fighting landed him in solitary confinement, a dark hole with dirt walls ominously similar to the basement where Ethel once locked him as a child. He preferred being in the hole because it meant no one would bother him. As soon as they let him out, he'd fight another soldier or get belligerent with an officer, and they'd throw him back in. He spent 9 months in the service, most of it sitting in the hole, growing angrier and angrier. After multiple psychiatric evaluations and treatments, Joe was discharged for an inability to adjust emotionally to military life. His family had hoped the military would help control his rage and teach him some discipline and respect for authority. Instead, he came out of the military angrier than ever. A week or so after Joe got home from the military, a tall, skinny neighborhood kid named Ivy walked up to him with a knife and asked him if he wanted to start something. Most people wouldn't have done that. At 19, Joe was at least 4 inches shorter than Ivy and only 155 pounds, but people in the neighborhood called him Crazy Joe because he seemed to enjoy violence. Ivy didn't care. He'd been drinking heavily and shooting heroin for years, and he was covered in scars from fighting. He told Joe he was going to kill him. Joe ignored Ivy the first time. Then, about 3 months later, on September 12, 1970, Joe was walking down an East Baltimore street with his friend June. It was Saturday night. They'd been drinking, and they'd just started talking up a group of young girls when three other men walked up the street toward them. One of those men was Eldridge Lee Ivy. When Ivy saw Joe and June talking to the girls, he yelled, saying one of them was his cousin and they'd better stop messing with her. "I'm tired of your junk," June yelled back. The two started arguing, and when Ivy threatened to punch June in the face, Joe jumped between them, calmly telling Ivy he would do no such thing. Ivy grabbed Joe by the neck, choking him while his two friends tried to pull him off. Joe kicked and yelled, "I'm gonna kill your motherfucking ass!" But Ivy beat him bloody, while June watched, terrified. That night, Joe knocked on Deborah's door. He stared ahead, covered in blood, eyes burning with hate as she cleaned his face and put him on her couch to sober up with some ice packs. He glared at the wall all night, looking scarier and angrier than Deborah had ever seen a person look. The next morning, Joe went into Deborah's kitchen and took her good carving knife with the black wood handle. 2 days later, on September 15, 1970, Joe went to work at his job driving for a local trucking company. By 5 o'clock, he and a co-worker had shared a fifth of old granddad whiskey, then another pint. It was still daylight out when Joe got off work and walked to the corner of Landvale and Montford Avenues in East Baltimore, where Ivy stood on the front stoop of his house, talking to some friends. Joe crossed the street and said, "Hi, Ivy," then stabbed him in the chest with Deborah's knife. The blade went straight through Ivy's heart. He staggered down the street and into a neighbor's house with Joe close behind, then collapsed face down into a pool of his own blood, yelling, "Oh, I'm dying. Call an ambulance." But it was too late. When a fireman arrived a few minutes later, Ivy was dead. Joe walked away from the murder scene, dropped the knife in a nearby alley, and headed to a payphone to call his father. But the police had beaten him to it. They'd told Day his son had killed a boy. Sonny and Lawrence told their father to get Joe to Clover, back to the tobacco farms, where he could hide from the law and be safe. Deborah said they were crazy. "He got to turn himself in," she told them. "The police got a warrant out saying he wanted dead or alive." But the men didn't listen. Day gave Joe $20 and put him on a trailways bus to Clover. In Laxtown, Joe drank all day, picked fights with his cousins, and threatened to kill several of them, including Cootie. By the end of Joe's first week, Cootie called Day saying somebody had better come get Joe before he killed someone else or got himself shot. Sonny borrowed Day's car, picked Joe up in Clover, and took him to D.C. to stay with a friend. But Joe couldn't get along there either. The next morning, he called Sonny and said, "Come pick me up. I want to turn myself in." On the morning of September 29, 1970, Joe walked into the Baltimore police headquarters and calmly said, "I'm Joe Lax. I'm wanted because I killed Ivy." Then he filled out this form. "Is the defendant employed? No. Cash on hand or in banks? Zero. Name of parents? David Lax. Have they been to see you? No. Do you have any friends or members of your family that can get you an attorney? No. Can't afford one." After that, Joe waited. He knew he was going to plead guilty. He just wanted to get on with it. After 5 months awaiting trial in a cell, Joe wrote this letter to the criminal court judge. "Dear Sir or Your Honor, And the most critical time on this earth is now, on this atmosphere today, of my mistake. No, I'll say wrong comprehension of corruption that I've placed on myself. A very mislead problem that was not meant to be. Feel so frustration in making me obnoxious within me, asking for a speedily trial to let me know what lays ahead in the future. I feel as though I'd sure be castigated or chastised for the wrong I've did, so I'm ready to get it over now with it. Joe Lax. Speedily trial. Thank you, Your Honor. Finally, on April 6, 1971, 7 months after Ivy's death, Joe stood in a courtroom and pleaded guilty to murder in the second degree, with Sonny watching nearby. The judge warned Joe repeatedly that a guilty plea meant waiving his right to a trial, his right to testify, and his right to appeal her ruling. As the judge spoke, he said,
"Yes, ma'am,"
and
"No, ma'am."
He told her the alcohol had made him do it, and that he hadn't meant to kill Ivy.
"I tried to hit on the top of his shoulder, and he panicked and turned and caught it in the chest," Joe said. "I was trying to wound him so I wouldn't let him hurt me. He told me he was going to kill me that Saturday night me and him got into the argument. I just hope you see I was trying to protect my life. I was not really wanting any trouble out of no one at all."
But Ivy's 14-year-old neighbor, who'd seen the whole thing, said Joe had walked right up and stabbed Ivy in the chest, then tried to stab him again in the back as he staggered away. When Joe stepped from the stand, his court-appointed lawyer approached the judge to make this final point.
"The only thing I would add, Your Honor, is that I talked to his brother about the young man, and the problem that he also had in the army is a problem that possibly got him into the situation he is in court for today. For some reason, somewhere in his life, he has gotten an inferiority complex, and it seems to be a sizable one. It seems that whenever he is confronted by any individual, he sort of takes it rather aggressively, more so than the average individual. For the record, he had some psychiatric help in the service, but he has never been in any hospital."
Without knowing anything about Joe's life or the abuse he experienced as a child, his lawyer said, "He feels it more necessary to protect himself than the average individual, and possibly this sets him off, where it would not set off the average person."
"Do people call you Crazy Joe?"
the judge asked.
"There was a few friends that called me that,"
Joe said.
"Do you know why they call you that?"
"No, ma'am,"
he said. The judge accepted Joe's guilty plea, but asked to see medical and psychiatric reports before deciding his sentence. Those records are sealed, but whatever they contained led her to give him a sentence of only 15 years out of a possible 30. The state sent Joe to the Maryland Correctional Institution in Hagerstown, a medium security prison about 75 miles west of Baltimore. In the beginning, Joe spent his time in prison much as he'd spent it in the military, in the hole for insubordination and fighting. But eventually, he stopped fighting and focused his energy inward. Joe found Islam and began spending all his time studying the Quran in his cell. Soon, he changed his name to Zakaria Bari Abdul Rahman. Meanwhile, on the outside, things were looking pretty good for the other Lax brothers. Sonny had just been honorably discharged from the Air Force, and Lawrence had a good job working for the railroad. But things weren't so good for Deborah. By the time Zakaria ended up in prison, Deborah had married Cheetah in a blue chiffon dress in Bobette and Lawrence's living room. She was 18. When Deborah and Cheetah first met, he threw a bowling ball at her on the sidewalk in front of her house. She thought he was playing, but things only got worse after they married. Soon after their second child, Latonya, was born, Cheetah fell into drugs and started beating Deborah when he was high. Then he started running the streets, disappearing with other women for nights on end,
and coming back only to sell drugs out of the house while Deborah's children sat and watched. One day, as Deborah stood at the sink doing dishes, her hands covered in soap bubbles, Cheetah ran into the kitchen yelling something about her sleeping around on him. Then he smacked her.
"Don't do that again," Deborah said, standing stone still, her hands in the dishwater.
Cheetah grabbed a plate from the drying rack and broke it across the side of her face.
"Don't you put your hands back on me no more,"
Deborah screamed, her hand shooting out of the dishwater, gripping a serrated steak knife. Cheetah raised his arm to hit her again, but he was clumsy from the drugs and booze. Deborah blocked him with her empty hand and pinned him against the wall. She stuck the tip of the knife into his chest just deep enough to break the skin, then dragged it down past his navel as Cheetah screamed, calling her crazy. He left her alone for a few days after that, but eventually came home drunk and high and started beating her again. As Cheetah kicked her one night in the living room, Deborah yelled,
"Why do you always have to be arguing and fussing with me?"
When he didn't answer, Deborah decided right then she wanted him dead. He turned and staggered toward the stairs of their apartment, still yelling, and Deborah pushed him hard as she could. He tumbled to the bottom where he lay bleeding. Deborah stared at him from the top of the stairs, feeling nothing, no fear, no emotion. When he moved, she walked down the steps and dragged him through their basement onto the sidewalk outside. It was the middle of winter and snowing. Deborah dropped him on the ground in front of the house without a coat, slammed the door, and went upstairs to sleep. The next morning, she woke up hoping he'd frozen to death. But instead, he was sitting on their front stoop, bruised and cold.
"I feel like some guys jumped me and beat me up," he told her.
She let him in the house and got him washed and fed, all the while thinking what a damn fool he was. While Cheetah slept it off, Deborah called Bobette saying,
"This is it. He gonna die tonight."
"What are you talking about?"
Bobette asked.
"I got the monkey wrench," Deborah said. "I'm gonna splatter his brains all over the wall. I'm sick of it."
"Don't do it, Dale," Bobette said. "Look where it got Zakaria. He's in jail. You kill that man, then what about your children? Now get that monkey wrench out of there."
The next day, after Cheetah left for work, a moving van pulled up to the house. Deborah took the children and everything they owned, then hid at her father's house until she could find her own apartment. As Deborah worked two jobs and struggled to settle into her new life as a single mother, she had no idea she was about to get news that would be harder to handle than anything Cheetah had done. Chapter 20. The Gila Bomb, 1966. In September 1966, a geneticist named Stanley Gartler walked up to the podium at a hotel in Bedford, Pennsylvania. There, in front of George Guy and the other giants of cell culture, Gartler announced that he'd found a technical problem in their field. He was at the second decennial review conference on cell tissue and organ culture, with more than 700 other scientists. They'd come from biotech companies and academia. They'd traveled from New York, England, the Netherlands, Alaska, Japan, and everywhere between to discuss the future of cell culture. The room buzzed with excitement as everyone talked about cell cloning and hybrids, mapping human genes, and using cultures to cure cancer. Few there had heard of Stanley Gartler, but that was about to change. Gartler leaned into the microphone and told the audience that in the process of looking for new genetic markers for his research, he'd found that 18 of the most commonly used cell cultures had one thing in common. They all contained a rare genetic marker called glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase A, G6PDA, which was present almost exclusively in black Americans, and even among them it was fairly rare. I have not been able to ascertain the supposed racial origin of all 18 lines, Gartler told the audience. It is known, however, that at least some of these are from Caucasians, and that at least one, Hila, is from a Negro. He knew this, because a few months earlier he'd written George Guy. I am interested in the racial origin of the person from whom your Hila cell line was initiated. I have checked a number of the early papers describing the development of the Hila cell line, but have not been able to find any information pertaining to the race of the donor. When Guy responded that Hila cells had come from a colored woman, Gartler knew he'd found the source of the problem. It seems to me the simplest explanation, he told the audience, is that they are all Hila cell contaminants. Scientists knew they had to keep their cultures free from bacterial and viral contamination, and they knew it was possible for cells to contaminate one another if they got mixed up in culture. But when it came to Hila, they had no idea what they were up against. It turned out Henrietta's cells could float through the air on dust particles. They could travel from one culture to the next on unwashed hands or used pipettes. They could ride from lab to lab on researchers' coats and shoes or through ventilation systems. And they were strong. If just one Hila cell landed in a culture dish, it took over, consuming all the media and filling all the space. Gartler's findings did not go over well. In the 15 years since Guy had first grown Hila, the number of published articles involving cell culture had more than tripled each year. Scientists had spent millions conducting research on those cells to study the behavior of each tissue type, comparing one to another, testing the unique responses of different cell types to specific drugs, chemicals, or environments. If all those cells were in fact Hila, it would mean that millions of dollars had been wasted, and researchers who'd found that various cells behave differently in culture could have some explaining to do. Years later, Robert Stevenson, who became president of the American Type Culture Collection, described Gartler's talk to me this way. He showed up at that meeting with no background or anything else in cell culture and proceeded to drop a turd in the punch bowl. Stevenson and other members of the Cell Culture Collection Committee sat stunned in the audience as Gartler pointed to a chart on the wall listing the 18 cell lines that had been contaminated by Hila, along with the names of the people or places he'd gotten them from. At least 6 of the contaminated lines came from the ATCC. Hila had penetrated Fort Knox. At that point, the ATCC's collection had grown to dozens of different types of cells, all guaranteed to be free from viral and bacterial contamination and tested to ensure that they hadn't been contaminated with cells from another species. But there was no test to see if one human cell had contaminated another. And to the naked eye, most cells growing in culture looked the same. Now, Gartler was essentially telling the audience that all those years researchers thought they were creating a library of human tissues, they'd probably just been growing and regrowing Hila. He pointed out that a few years earlier, when scientists started taking protective measures against cross-species contamination, such as working under sterile hoods, it had suddenly become harder to grow new cell lines. And in fact, very few new human cell lines have been reported since. Not only that, he said, but there had been no new examples of so-called spontaneous transformed human cell cultures since. Everyone in the audience knew what that meant. On top of saying they'd possibly wasted more than a decade and millions of research dollars, Gartler was also suggesting that spontaneous transformation, one of the most celebrated prospects for finding a cure for cancer, might not exist. Normal cells didn't spontaneously become cancerous, he said. They were simply taken over by Hila. Gartler concluded his talk by saying,
"Where the investigator has assumed a specific tissue of origin of the cell line, in other words, liver or bone marrow, the work is open to serious question, and in my opinion, would best be discarded."
The room sat silent, dumbfounded, until T.C. Hsu, the chair of Gartler's conference session, spoke. Hsu was the University of Texas geneticist whose earlier work with HeLa and other cells had made it possible to discover the correct number of human chromosomes.
"A few years ago, I voiced some suspicion about cell line contamination," Hsu said. "So I am happy about the paper by Dr. Gartler, and am also sure he has made many people unhappy."
He was right, and those people quickly began asking questions.
"How long did you keep them in your laboratory?"
one scientist asked, suggesting that Gartler had contaminated the cells himself after they arrived in his lab.
"They were analyzed before being grown in my laboratory," Gartler responded.
"They didn't send them to you frozen?"
the scientist asked, knowing that contamination could have occurred while they thawed. Gartler said that didn't matter. The cells didn't have to be thawed to be tested. Another scientist wanted to know if the similarity Gartler was seeing between cell lines was just the effect of spontaneous transformation making all cells act the same. Eventually, Robert Stevenson of the Cell Culture Collection Committee spoke up, saying,
"It looks like more detective work is needed to see whether we are going to have to start all over again to isolate some new human cell lines."
Hsu stepped in and said, "I would like to give particular priority to those who initiated the cell lines, whom Dr. Gartler has attacked. If there is any defense, we would like to hear it." Harvard's Robert Chang, whose widely used Chang liver cell line was listed as a HeLa contaminant on Gartler's chart, glared from his seat. Chang had used those cells to discover enzymes and genes specific to liver cells. If Gartler was right and the cells were actually from Henrietta's cervix, Chang's liver research using them was worthless. Leonard Hayflick had an especially personal connection with his cell line, Wish, which Gartler had listed as contaminated. He'd grown it using cells from the amniotic sac in which his unborn daughter had once floated. He asked Gartler whether it was possible to find G6PDA in samples from white people.
"Caucasian subjects with G6PDA have not been reported," Gartler told him.
Later that day, in a talk chaired by George Guy, Hayflick delivered a paper on the facts and theories of spontaneous transformation of cells in culture. Before beginning his talk, Hayflick stood at the podium and announced that since Wish cells supposedly tested positive for a genetic marker found only in black people, he called his wife during the break to ask if he was, in fact, his daughter's father.
"She assured me that my worst fears were unfounded," Hayflick said.
The room erupted in laughter, and no one said anything else publicly about Gartler's findings. But a few people took Gartler seriously. Before leaving the conference, Stevenson met several of the top cell culturalists for lunch. He told them to go back to their labs after the conference and start testing cells for the G6PDA genetic marker to see how widespread this problem might be. Many of their cell lines tested positive, including the skin cells George Hyatt had transplanted onto a soldier's arm years earlier. Since Hyatt had no HeLa cells in his lab at the time, the cells in his experiment must have been contaminated before they arrived. And though few realized it, the same thing was happening in laboratories around the world. Still, many scientists refused to believe HeLa contamination was real. After the conference, where Gartler dropped what became known as the HeLa bomb, most researchers kept right on working with the cells he'd said were contaminated. But Stevenson and a few other scientists realized the potential scope of the HeLa contamination problem. So they began working to develop genetic tests that could specifically identify HeLa cells in culture instead of just testing for the presence of G6PDA. And those genetic tests would eventually lead them to Henrietta's family. Chapter 21, Night Doctors, 2000. 2 months after Sonny Lack stood me up, I sat waiting for him again, this time in the lobby of the Baltimore Holiday Inn. It was New Year's Day, and he was nearly 2 hours late. I figured he'd backed out again, so I started packing to leave. Then I heard a man's voice yell, "So you're Miss Rebecca?" Suddenly, Sonny was standing beside me with a sweet and bashful gap-toothed grin that made him look like a 50-year-old teenager. He laughed and patted me on the back. "You just won't give up, will you?" he said. "I got to tell you, only person I know more hard-headed than you is my sister, Dale." He grinned and straightened his black driving cap. "I tried to convince her to come meet you today, but she won't listen." Sonny had a loud laugh and mischievous eyes that squinted nearly closed when he smiled. His face was warm and handsome, open to the world. He was thin, 5'9" at most, with a carefully manicured mustache. He reached for my bag. "Okay, then," he said. "We best get this thing going." I followed him to a Volvo he'd left unlocked and idling in the parking lot next to the hotel. He'd borrowed it from one of his daughters. "Nobody wants to ride in my raggedy old van," he said, easing the car into gear. "You ready to go see the big kahuna?"
"The big kahuna?"
"Yep," he said, grinning. "Deborah says you got to talk to our brother Lawrence before anybody else talked to you. He'll check you out, decide what's what. If he say it's okay, then maybe the rest of us will talk to you." We drove in silence for several blocks. "Lawrence is the only one of us kids who remembers our mother," Sonny said eventually. "Deborah and I don't know nothing about her."
Then, without looking from the road, Sonny told me everything he knew about his mother.
"Everybody say she was real nice and cooked good," he said. "Pretty, too. Her cells have been blowed up in nuclear bombs. From her cells came all these different creations, medical miracles like polio vaccines, some cure for cancer and other things, even AIDS. She liked taking care of people, so it makes sense what she did with them cells. I mean, people always say she was really just hospitality, you know? Fixing everything up nice, making a good place, get up, cook breakfast for everybody, even if it's 20 of them."
He pulled into an empty alley behind a row of red brick townhouses and looked at me for the first time since we'd gotten in the car.
"This is where we take scientists and reporters wanting to know about our mother. It's where the family gangs up on them," he said, laughing. "But you seem nice, so I'll do you a favor and not go get my brother Zakaria this time."
I got out of the car, and Sonny drove away yelling,
"Good luck!"
out the window. All I knew about Sonny's brothers was that they were angry and one of them had murdered someone. I wasn't sure which one or why. A few months earlier, when Deborah gave me Lawrence's phone number and swore she'd never talk to me, she'd said,
"Brother gets mad when white folks come asking about our mother."
As I walked through a narrow half-cement yard from the alley to Lawrence's house, a wisp of smoke seeped through the screen door of his kitchen, where static blared from a small television on a folding table. I knocked, then waited. Nothing. I stuck my head into the kitchen, where fat pork chops sat burning on the stove. I yelled hello. Still nothing. I took a deep breath and walked inside.
As I closed the door behind me, Lawrence appeared, seeming bigger than two of me, his 275-pound, 6-foot frame spanning the width of the narrow kitchen, one hand on the counter, the other on the opposite wall.
"Well, hello there, Miss Rebecca," he said,
giving me a once-over.
"You want to taste the meat I cooked?"
It had been a decade or so since I'd eaten pork, but suddenly that seemed irrelevant. "How could I resist?" I said. A sweet grin spread across Lawrence's face. He was 64, but aside from his gray curls, he seemed decades younger, with smooth hazelnut brown skin and youthful brown eyes. He hiked up his baggy blue jeans, wiped his hands on his grease-stained T-shirt, and clapped.
"Okay, then," he said. "That's good. That's real good. I'm gonna fry you up some eggs, too. You're too damn skinny."
While he cooked, Lawrence talked about life down in the country.
"When older folks went to town to sell tobacco, they'd come back with a piece of bologna for us kids to share. And sometimes, if we were good, they let us sop up the bacon grease with a piece of bread."
His memory for detail was impressive. He drew pictures of the horse-drawn wagon Day had made out of 2x4s. He showed me, with string and napkins, how he tied tobacco into bundles for drying when he was a child. But when I asked about his mother, Lawrence fell silent. Eventually, he said,
"She was pretty."
Then he went back to talking about tobacco. I asked about Henrietta again, and he said,
"My father and his friends used to race horses up and down Lexington Road."
We went in circles like this until he sighed and told me he didn't remember his mother. In fact, he said, he didn't remember most of his teen years.
"I blacked it out of my mind because of the sadness and hurtin'," he told me,
and he had no intention of unblocking it.
"The only memory I have about my mother is her being strict," he told me.
He remembered her making him hand-wash diapers in the sink. He'd hang them to dry, then she'd dump them back in the water, saying they weren't clean enough. But the only times she whipped him were for swimming off the pier in Turner Station.
"She'd make me go fetch a switch to get it beaten with, then send me back out saying to get a bigger one, then a bigger one, then she'd wrap all them together and haul off on my tail."
As he talked, the kitchen filled with smoke again. We'd both forgotten he was cooking. Lawrence shooed me from the kitchen table into the living room, where he sat me in front of a plastic Christmas placemat with a plate of fried eggs and a chunk of charred pork the size of my hand, only thicker. Then he collapsed into a wooden chair beside me, put his elbows on his knees, and stared at the floor in silence while I ate.
"You're writing a book about my mama," he said finally.
I nodded as I chewed.
"Her cells growing big as the world, cover around the whole earth," he said,
his eyes tearing as he waved his arms in the air, making a planet around him.
"That's kind of weird. They're just steady growing and growing, steady fighting off whatever they fighting off."
He leaned forward in his chair, his face inches from mine, and whispered,
"You know what I heard? I heard by the year 2050, babies will be injected with serum made from my mama's cells so they can live to 800 years old."
He gave me a smile like, "I bet your mama can't top that."
"They're going to get rid of disease," he said. "They're a miracle."
Lawrence fell back in his chair and stared into his lap, his smile collapsing. After a long, quiet moment, he turned and looked into my eyes.
"Can you tell me what my mama's cells really did?" he whispered. "I know they did something important, but nobody tells us nothing."
When I asked if he knew what a cell was, he stared at his feet as if I'd called on him in class and he hadn't done his homework.
"Kinda," he said. "Not really."
I tore a piece of paper from my notebook, drew a big circle with a small black dot inside, and explained what a cell was, then told him some of the things Hila had done for science and how far cell culture had come since. "Scientists can even grow corneas now," I told him, reaching into my bag for an article I'd clipped from a newspaper. I handed it to him and told him that using culturing techniques Hila helped develop, scientists could now take a sample of someone's cornea, grow it in culture, then transplant it into someone else's eye to help treat blindness.
"Imagine that," Lawrence said, shaking his head. "It's a miracle."
Suddenly, Sonny threw open the screen door, yelling, "Miss Rebecca still alive in here?" He leaned in the doorway between the kitchen and the living room.
"Looks like you passed the test," he said,
pointing at my half-empty plate.
"Miss Rebecca telling me about our mother's cells," Lawrence said. "She told me fascinating stuff. Did you know our mother's cells gonna be used to make Stevie Wonder see?"
"Oh, well, actually, it's not her cells being put into people's eyes," I said, stammering. "Scientists are using technology her cells helped develop to grow other people's corneas."
"That's a miracle," Sonny said. "I didn't know about that. But the other day, President Clinton said the polio vaccine is one of the most important things that happened in the 20th century. And her cells involved with that, too."
"That's a miracle," Lawrence said.
"So is this,"
Sonny said, slowly spreading his arms and stepping aside to reveal his 84-year-old father, Day, teetering on unsteady legs behind him. Day hadn't left the house in nearly a week because of a nosebleed that wouldn't stop. Now, he stood in the doorway in faded jeans, a flannel shirt, and blue plastic flip-flops, even though it was January. He was thin and frail, barely able to hold himself upright. His light brown face had grown tough with age, cracked but soft, like a pair of well-worn work boots. His silver hair was covered with a black driving cap identical to Sonny's.
"He's got the gangrene in his feet,"
Sonny said, pointing to Day's toes, which were several shades darker than the rest of him and covered with open sores.
"His feet hurt too much in regular shoes."
Gangrene was spreading from Day's toes to his knee. His doctor said his toes needed amputating, but Day refused. He said he didn't want doctors cutting on him, like they did Henrietta. At 52, Sonny felt the same way. His doctor said he needed angioplasty, but he swore he'd never do it. Day sat beside me, brown plastic sunglasses shading his constantly tearing eyes.
"Daddy," Lawrence yelled, "did you know Mama Cell's gonna make Stevie Wonder see?"
Day shook his head in what looked like slow motion.
"Nope," he mumbled. "Didn't know that till just now. Don't surprise me none, though."
Then there was a thump on the ceiling and the rustling of someone walking around, and Lawrence jumped from the table and ran into the kitchen.
"My wife is a fire dragon without morning coffee," he said. "I better make some."
It was 2 in the afternoon. A few minutes later, Babette Lax walked down the stairs and through the living room slowly, wearing a faded blue terry cloth robe. Everyone stopped talking as she passed and headed into the kitchen without saying a word or looking at anyone. Babette seemed like a loud person being quiet, like a woman with an enormous laugh and temper who might erupt with either at any moment. She exuded, "Don't mess with me," her face stern and staring straight ahead. She knew why I was there and had plenty to say on the subject, but seemed utterly exhausted at the idea of talking to me, yet another white person wanting something from the family. She disappeared into the kitchen, and Sonny slid a crumpled piece of paper into Day's hand, a printout of the picture of Henrietta with her hands on her hips. He grabbed my tape recorder from the center of the table, handed it to Day, and said,
"Okay. Miss Rebecca got questions for you, Pop. Tell her what you know."
Day took the recorder from Sonny's hand and said nothing.
She just want to know everything Dale always asking you about, Sonny said.
I asked Sonny if maybe he could call Deborah to see if she'd come over, and the lax men shook their heads, laughing.